Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, featuring unique shopping in the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a busy day planned, and we're going to start with Russell Johnson, who is with the music faculty at UW Parkside. Well, he is actually with the music faculty at Carthage, our trumpet instructor at Carthage, but director of jazz studies at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And he is visiting us at the morning show for the next few minutes to talk about one of the most exciting weeks of the whole school year as far as the music department is concerned at Parkside, namely Jazz Week. And jazz has been a very important part of the Parkside music scene for as long as I can remember, for as long as I've been around here, and certainly even before Russell Johnson came on the scene. But he has taken something that was built into something truly great by, among other people, the late great Tim Bell, and continued it on into still more greatness. And next week will be Jazz Week at Parkside, and so Professor Johnson is here to talk about all that is being offered to the public, and including some really, really exciting events. Russell Johnson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
How long have you been at Parkside now?
It's actually 10 years. I started.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, which is hard to believe. The aforementioned late, great Tim Bell retired mid-year in 2010. I think his accountant told him that was the right time. So I was still living in New York at the time, and I ended up starting in January of 2010, and I commuted from New York for a year and a half before moving my family here. So I've been there 10 years.
Wow. Not that this is the primary reason you're here, but for the sake of somebody who does not quite understand your background, mm-hmm. and who you are and the impressive credentials that you bring to the job, just sketch for our listeners the really rich musical life you had before coming to Parkside.
Sure. This is not what I would recommend, but I dropped out of school at 19. I attended Parkside under Tim Bell, and I'm very thankful for that. And then I went to Berkeley in Boston. And my parents didn't have the money to afford that, and I didn't have the money to afford Berkeley. Mm-hmm. So I kind of dropped out, floated around for a couple of years. I eventually moved to New York in my early 20s when I was 22. And I lived there until, so that was 1988, just about turned 23. And I was there until 2011. You know, I made my career as somebody who... I'm a jazz musician, I'm a composer, but I also did some commercial music. I did some film work, I did some literal commercial jingles. I did all kinds of things. When you first move to New York, it's always the struggle, how do you pay your bills? So I did whatever I had to do to pay my bills musically. Never had a day job, thankfully.
Wow.
Until I started at Parkside at age 45, I did not have a day job from 19 to 45 other than playing my trumpet.
Wow, so. And there's not very many people who can say that.
Yeah, and you know, it's all as always, it's a product of hard work and perseverance in many ways.
Very
so I was in New York for 23 years and creating my own music, managed to tour globally, work with quite a few really famous jazz musicians, but yet have my own voice as a composer and instrumentalist as well.
Fantastic. Well, the transition to Parkside has been amazingly seamless, at least as far as I can tell. And what has this been like, this new chapter in your professional life?
You know, it's been great. I grew up in Racine. I feel like I kind of know these kids.
Hmm.
I know who they are. So it for me, it wasn't, you know, coming from New York, it wasn't a huge transition because of my upbringing, excuse me, here. So I feel like I have kind of a handle on who these kids are.
Hmm.
I mean, it's honestly, you know, my predecessor, Tim Bell, had such an amazing impact on the community, and he had an amazing library of music at Parkside.
Mm.
So that allowed me to kind of get started right away. And then I've been just basically trying to, you know, I guess, put my vision out there of what the music is today in 2020. You know, I think it's important as all arts evolve, and I want to keep evolving with the time. So for me, it's just a matter of trying to, for myself, to stay updated with what's happening and then try and bring what's happening now to the musicians we have at Parkside today. Mm.
So before we talk about all that is being offered next week in terms of Jazz Week, mm-hmm. I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear a little bit about what it means to study jazz, and maybe more specifically also what it means to study jazz at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. First of all, is that sort of an official degree or an emphasis within your music major that is available, and if so, what does it entail?
So it's technically it's called a concentration. So you can get a music performance degree, and then you can take a concentration in jazz studies. And you know, it's funny. I was looking at the catalogs for other University of Wisconsin system schools, and honestly, our program is a little more in depth than some of the others. Hmm. Than most. That I should say, the coursework's actually more challenging, I would say, than all of the others. If you're in the jazz studies program, you take four different semesters of jazz theory. You take a jazz arranging course, a jazz history course, a course called styles and analysis. So it's quite an in-depth concentration. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say this, the faculty we have is truly, truly outstanding. The saxophone instructor is Chris Madsen, one of the busiest guys in Chicago. Mm-hmm. James Sodke, the piano instructor, has been in this area forever and is an amazing musician. Tim Ipsen, a Kenosha native who was in Chicago for many years, moved back, is teaching bass. Dave Bayless on drums. He's, I would say, the workingest drummer in the state of Wisconsin. He's been in Milwaukee forever. And yeah, the faculty is truly, truly outstanding.
Mm. Do you find that young musicians, when they come to you, do they even have the vaguest idea of what it means to study jazz? I ask that because jazz is one of those things that I think is easily misunderstood, perhaps even by those who practice it, you know, as youngsters. But I think a lot of people operate under this misconception that the whole point of jazz is, in a sense, not knowing anything or not trying to do anything real specific, but just kind of letting things spontaneously happen, which of course is a real misunderstanding of the art form.
100%. And I've had to go to bat for my music on several occasions, including amongst colleagues. There's a misconception about the music. This is Black American music. It's African American music. The culture of this music developed in New Orleans. The music is rhythmically solely comes from African musical traditions. There's Western influence and harmony. The answer to your first question was no. I don't believe my students have an understanding when they really start to dive into it. It's an incredibly rich and deep musical culture that if you want to play it well, like anything, you have to understand the basic building blocks of music. And in some ways, I think you have to understand them more. For people that grow up learning classical music, pianists and such, oftentimes, and horn players as well, they're so used to reading all of the time that they don't actually see the harmony that they're playing. Mm-hmm. They're just notes on a page. And in jazz music, you have to put the fundamental and high level understanding of harmony into immediate action. So you have the same chord structures that Bach played. harmony is harmony. C, E, G in most cultures is a C major triad, no matter what type of music you're playing. So you have to have this understanding, I would say, actually on a deeper level than somebody who's only reading music all the time. Because when you're asked to improvise, which is a huge part of the culture, you have to put this practice of understanding harmony in depth into real-time practice. And that's an enormous challenge. And I feel like, you know, people that are first approaching this music think, yeah, well, you're just making up it as you go along, and there is a grain of truth to that, but it's one grain out of a pile of sand with many. I have to remember that one.
Yeah, that's a good image. A very, very good image. So, for those of you just joining us, Russell Johnson is with us for part one of today's morning show. He is director of jazz studies at UW Parkside, and next week is Jazz Week, and that means Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings, there are performances at Parkside, most of which are free and which are open to the public to enjoy. So, talk us through what I know is, as far as you're concerned, a really, really exciting lineup.
I'm very, very fortunate. I'm able to call on a lot of favors from friends that are in the business. One of the ways that we make this happen, these are all internationally known artists, and I mean that, internationally known. They all tour globally. Mm-hmm. I'm able to call in favors. I'm friends with some of them from my time in New York or my playing in Chicago. And for me, it's really an opportunity to present world-class music to the Kenosha and Racine public, and mostly at no charge, which is really amazing. I mean, we want to get as many people on campus as we can, into the Rita as we can, into Bedford Hall as we can, and promote our department. One of the things that's truly special to me is for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the artists that we bring in will do a one-hour performance, and then we do a 45 to 50-minute Q&A afterwards. And I feel like my students get so much out of that, maybe even sometimes more than the performance, because they get to ask questions of these incredible artists. And, you know, as artists want to do, they don't always provide easy, convenient answers. Right. Ooh, I mean, I think the conversation is pointed. I think it's radical in some ways. I think it's like I said, it's insight into the artistic process, and no two artists' process is the same, and that's really a beautiful thing. This year, it's funny. I'm a trumpet player myself, and this year I have several on the docket, but in past years I probably haven't had as many trumpet player band leaders. But yeah, it's an amazing opportunity for our students and for the general public. And one of the amazing things that's happened is every year the attendance has grown. It's been really fantastic.
Fabulous. I know that you're especially excited about one group that is coming in that I must confess I am not acquainted with at all, but then again, I'm not a connoisseur of jazz whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, I know one of my voice students, who's one of your trumpet students, is over the moon excited that the Bad Plus is coming.
Right.
So tell us why we should all be excited about this.
Well, that's so the Bad Plus is, the big jazz magazine is called Downbeat, and the Bad Plus is one every kind of award you can win in all the Downbeat categories. Band of the Year, Artist of the Year, Record of the Year. They're a group that tours constantly. It features Oren Evans on piano, Reed Anderson on bass, and Dave King on drums. They've been around. Oren Evans, the pianist, is a fairly recent addition of the last couple of years. Before that was a pianist named Ethan Iverson. And back in the late 90s and early 2000s, they were one of the first jazz groups to really kind of incorporate, for lack of a better word, pop tunes, current pop tunes, into their repertoire. So it follows the jazz aesthetic. There's tons of improvisation, but they do, sometimes incorporate some popular tunes. Like I said, they travel, they are constantly touring. And honestly, like I said, I would say that about all of the artists that we have. On Monday night, we have Jamie Branch and Fly or Die. Jamie's a trumpet player who's living in New York, who was in Chicago for many years, and she has just over the last 2 years, 3 years, just kind of exploded. Her popularity has exploded. Now, she's always been a great musician, just sometimes it takes, it takes for somebody to catch on and kind of promote it. Tuesday is Ben Lamar Gay, a cornet player and vocalist from Chicago. I play with Ben pretty regularly in the saxophonist Greg Ward's group. And the thing I'll say about Ben is everything he does is musical. Walking is musical. talking is musical. I don't think he can exist without being musical. And his music is very eclectic. Marquise Hill is Wednesday evening's concert, and Marquise is, I don't know if I can say favorite. I love a lot of musicians. Marquise is one of the heaviest musicians on the planet right now. He's absolutely amazing, and a friend. I play with him in different contexts as well. And then Saturday night we have a great guitarist from Los Angeles named Bruce Foreman coming in, and the Southeast Wisconsin Hearing Center is sponsoring that event. Mm-hmm. So and then Friday we have the UW Parkside Jazz Ensembles. We're bringing in three Racine schools. I alternate every other year Racine and Kenosha schools. This year is Racine school, so Park, my alma mater, Horlick and Case will be in, along with Oak Creek High School. And then Friday at noon, we also have a UW Parkside faculty concert as well. The only ticketed concerts are the Thursday evening and Friday evening, so that's the Bad Plus, and then the Friday evening with the jazz ensemble.
Are these performances all in the Francis Bedford Recital Hall?
They are all in the Recital Hall, yeah.
Now that is, of course, one of the most beautiful performing spaces in all of southeastern Wisconsin. But I'm just trying to imagine what jazz is like in there. Does it work pretty well for that?
I'm not sure the name of the acoustician who designed the hall, but whomever that was did a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. It is an incredible hall. It sounds great for choirs. It sounds great for orchestra. But the magic of that space is they actually, you can adjust baffling and you can adjust curtains so that you can really kind of deaden the room. Because if it's too loud, if you had the same setting for a choir concert on a jazz concert, the sounds would just be bouncing all over the room. But with the fortunate way that the hall was designed, we can actually deaden that. So actually jazz groups sound fantastic in there. Yeah.
Well, that's really good to hear, and we trust that a lot of people are going to seek this out. So I suppose as you're reaching out to past colleagues and friends, sure, and so on, a lot of what determines the lineup of a given year's Jazz Week, in terms of the lineup of artists, has a lot to do with what their busy schedules will accommodate and who happens to be free night during Jazz Week.
That is 100% accurate. and what I usually do in the fall is I put out emails to friends or colleagues and say, hey, if you're on the road in March, let me know. Mm-hmm. The way it works with a lot of these artists is, the way it works for almost every artist, and I've been a touring artist for many years, is you need that one big gig that pays, that's your anchor gig, and then you fill in around it. So if you're, on a Monday night or a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night, and you can fill it in, you're happy to do so. So, yeah, it's a matter of routing for a lot of these musicians. And it's, this can be a great event to play on what might be considered an off night. So that's one of the ways I'm able to really bring in these incredible artists. And this year, like bringing in the Bad Plus and actually Marquise, the Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities, Leslie Walker, Dr. Leslie Walker, has really been exceptionally helpful in raising funds for the events. It's not easy. My students, I also owe a great debt to the Uline Corporation. My students actually go to their headquarters four times a year and perform concerts at the headquarters. And Uline then makes a contribution to our specifically the jazz department, and then that's how I fund this, because I wouldn't be able to do it, as everybody knows, budgets are tight everywhere. I wouldn't be able to do it with the budget that I receive. So there are a lot of people to thank when it comes to to making this week happen.
Yeah. So what would you point to as the major benefit of doing this? Anything beyond the obvious?
Well, the obvious is obvious for a reason. I get to hear all this amazing music, and that inspires me. It's really student and community based. For my students, we're pretty fortunate. We can drive an hour and be in Chicago, drive 40 minutes and be in Milwaukee, and they can go hear some amazing music. But it's not like living in New York, where you have these artists playing every night. So it's really an opportunity for my students again, the Q&A at the end of these sessions is extremely important. Every rehearsal I have after this week, I talk to my students and I bring up the topics that are brought up, and they get so much from really listening to these artists talk not only about their craft, but what it's like to make a living as a musician, the challenges that come with that, the incredible, you know, opportunities you get to travel. So it's an amazing opportunity for Kenosha and Racine residents to hear world-class music at, like, the Bad Plus. That's a $10 ticket, $5 for students. I guarantee you there's no place on the planet that you're hearing that band for $10. That doesn't exist. If you were to go hear them at a club in New York, you'd pay $60 plus $30 drink minimum.
Wow.
So it's one of those things where it's really an opportunity for our communities to experience this incredible music.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So if people want more information about all that's being offered with UW Parkside's Jazz Week, mm-hmm. What's the best way for them to seek sure. out more specifics?
uwp.edu/jazz. That has all of the information. It has artist bios. It has a complete schedule. That should get you all the information you need to know.
Fantastic. Russell Johnson is Director of Jazz Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and once again, he has put together a stellar lineup for Parkside's Jazz Week, which is next week, beginning on Monday evening, and free public performances Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday evening in Francis Bedford Recital Hall. Thursday, the big headliner, the Bad Plus, UW Parkside's own jazz ensemble with Racine Area High School and Oak Creek High mm-hmm. School jazz musicians on Friday night, and guitarist Bruce Foreman finishes things out on Saturday evening. And again, you can go to uwp.edu for more information. Russ Johnson, thank you so much. Congratulations on what sounds like a magnificent Jazz Week coming up, and thanks for being part of the morning show today to tell us about it.
Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate being able to talk about the music and with somebody who is so knowledgeable, so thank you.
So it is 8:33, and time for part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm happy to welcome back to the program Steve Musenden, who is Executive Director of the Racine Literacy Council. And we have talked with Steve on a number of different occasions about the really good work of the Racine Literacy Council, and they have a very big event that is coming up on the 21st of March that we want to talk about. But first, Steve Musenden, we welcome you back to the program.
Great. Thank you very much, Greg. As always, it's a pleasure speaking with you, and I look forward to our conversation.
So this is, I suppose, there's no particular season where things are especially busy all year round. I mean, there are always people knocking on your door wanting to access the services that are offered by the Racine Literacy Council. How are things going? Are you managing to keep up with the demand?
Funny you should mention that. It's actually at its peak season right now. Right now we're gearing up. We're revamping some of our programming. We've also added some additional services and looking for some additional outreach in the community.
So what is the need right now? I mean, how many people right now are you serving, and how many more people could you potentially be serving if you had even more volunteers in your ranks?
More volunteers equals, again, expanded services. Right now, we're looking to put in a lot more groups within the Literacy Council as far as the sessions are concerned. And so we're ramping up for that. Hopefully by the new fiscal year in July, we'll have everything in place, and you know, we'll be running on all cylinders at that point. But there's always a need for tutors. And then there's always a need for volunteers at the Racine Literacy Council.
We should probably remind people that the work of the Racine Literacy Council goes beyond the most sort of standard sense of the word. I mean, the literacy work that you do, that is the heart and soul, of course, of the Racine Literacy Council. But just remind our listeners about some of the other services that you offer that go beyond just that basic notion of of helping people, for instance, learn to read. What are some of the other things that are offered by the Literacy Council?
Right now, in March, we're getting ready to kick off our citizenship class. It goes from March 18th to May 6th, from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. That's roughly about a 6 to 8 week program. We also have tutor training, which is coming up in March 25th. And one of the things that we've added, we've always had driver's education and commercial driver's license testing preparation at RLC, but now we have it in both English and Spanish. So that's just another added value to the services we provide.
About the core mission of which is, of course, literacy. What are the different ways in which that is offered to the public?
When you come into the Literacy Council, one of the things, the way the program is set up, it's almost akin to when you have youth and trying to teach them, you kind of force feed information to them. With adults, it's totally different. while providing basic services, we have to provide something that's goal-oriented, something that's going to be relative and relatable to the student. Just trying to force-feed them information doesn't work, especially, like I said, with an adult. So we try to gear it where they both have the basic skills, and what are they looking to attain? What are they looking to do? What are their goals? And how is it customized to that particular individual? And that's where we maintain that level of customization for each of our students. So each student doesn't have the same goals. And so we address those at the RLC.
Wow. So in those cases, are we talking about people that are tutored one-on-one and in various ways?
Tutored one-on-one. The other thing that we've noticed as of late is we have a lot of entrepreneurs as students. And so in March and April, we'll be starting an entrepreneurship class, kind of give them the basics because they're just starting their businesses. And so that's the next facet of how to promote sustainability in the community. It goes reading, writing, arithmetic, financial literacy, health literacy. But for those people that want to start a business, how do you do that?
Wow. So if someone wants to become a hairdresser and start their own business or start their own car mechanic shop or something, is that's
correct.
And so you want to be in a position to help them have some of the basic information they need to really do that successfully.
That is correct. CDBG, Community Development Block Grant, last year introduced funding for entrepreneurs on a basic level, but a $5,000 grant is like a gold mine to someone just starting their own business.
Yeah.
So that's where it comes in hand. And they don't have access to those resources. Had I not presented that to them, they would not have been aware that those funding and those resources were available to them.
Wow. Wow. So you're always looking for more volunteers in order to expand the services that you provide. I know that some of your volunteers have a background in education, maybe as retired teachers or retired teachers' aides, but I know that it is not limited to that. I mean, those kind of credentials are not necessary for being a volunteer for the Literacy Council.
Greg, that is correct. We have a wide, varied tenure with our tutors, most who are former educators and teachers, but we provide training to the tutors. So they can get the message, the information across to the students where they feel comfortable. So it's not a prerequisite that they have to have any type of educational training in that regard.
And what about the kind of time commitment that it is required to be a tutor? Is there some variation or flexibility in terms of the kind of time that this demands of a volunteer?
We have some tutors that I think literally sleeps at the RLC. I mean, I see them so many times a week. Mary Gelhoff is one. Mrs. Peterson is another one. I mean, I see them and I run into them all the time. And I said, didn't you leave yet? We only require 2 hours, 2 hours of your time a week to come in and provide services to the students of the Literacy Council. But you have some tutors that just are totally engaged, totally committed, and they come in multiple times a week because either they're retired or they have that passion that everyone has at the Literacy Council.
Mm. So you have a very big event coming up that
Yes.
you are excited to tell us about.
Yes. over the last couple of years, we've had this moniker that we have. It's called Opening the Door to Education. It's kind of like our hashtag. And so our last couple of major fundraising events have been called the Open Door Event. We have this one on March 21st, Saturday at Memorial Hall. And it's from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. We have our keynote speaker is actually Mayor Corey Mason. We're excited about that. And then we have entertainment via the Madison's Piano, Dueling Pianos.
Ah, fun.
Yeah.
So if people are interested in attending that, what do they need to do?
They can go to our website, which is www.racineliteracy.com. We've had banners and posters, flyers throughout the city. And they can also call the Racine Literacy Council at 262-632-9495 for additional information.
Very good. A last question. For somebody who is in need of your services, is it just a matter of walking through the door or picking up the phone, or is there something else involved in terms of being able to access the various offerings of the Literacy Council?
Greg, you actually nailed it. Coming through the door and picking up the phone, that's the easiest way to get in touch with someone from the Literacy Council to find out what services are available to you and what time slots are available.
Very good. Steve Musidin is the Executive Director of the Racine Literacy Council. It's a very, very busy place and doing very, very good work in our community. Steve, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you, Greg, for having me.
The time is 8:41. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, and here is part three. And the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show are going to be spent with an important topic, that of colorectal cancer, and what people should be thinking about in terms of being properly screened, and what sorts of new developments there have been as medical science continues to combat this really serious form of cancer. My guest is Dr. Mike Pico, who is at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, a gastroenterologist there, an associate professor of medicine, and chair of the gastroenterology and hepatology department. Dr. Pico, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Good to be talking with you. How serious a problem are we talking about in terms of colorectal cancer? How does it compare to other kinds of cancers, both in terms of the suffering that it causes and to what extent this is something that proves to be fatal?
It's a leading cause for cancer death in the United States, and it's very preventable with appropriate screening and follow-up. And it does cause a lot of morbidity, a lot of suffering in patients who develop it.
We used to talk about colon cancer. Now more often we hear it referred to as colorectal cancer. Is there any particular reason for that slight shift in terminology?
Not really. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it should be looked at as the same. It's involving the colon, meaning starting from the lower end, the anus, all the way around the entire colon, what that term encompasses.
So in other words, we've gravitated to what amounts to a more correct or more specific term, because this cancer can involve that whole part of the body and all that is associated with it. My understanding is that, at least in general, people seem to be reluctant to be screened for this. I mean, maybe more reluctant than makes sense. To what extent is this a significant problem?
Well, it's a big problem, I think, and it really has to do with the types of tests that are available. You know, they really are broken down into three areas. The first are stool tests, and the stool tests are non-invasive, meaning no testing, nothing has to be done other than checking the stool. But as you imagine, people don't like to manipulate their stool and provide stool samples. There's some resistance there. The other test, for example, the CT colonography, or what is it called, virtual colonoscopy, is a radiographic test. That one is also requires time away from work and so forth. And then there's colonoscopy, which is a more invasive test where you actually put a scope in and people need to take a half a day, need to do a considerable colon prep, and have to be sedated for that procedure, taking time from work and so forth. So there are barriers that are out there for screening, and also there is kind of some misperceptions in the community about screening as well. For example, colonoscopy has a bad rap, and it really is, I think, undeserved. Definitely an invasive test, but typically the most difficult part about colonoscopy is the prep. most people who undergo the procedure, you know, with the sedation and the techniques that are involved will often forget that they even had it and typically go through the procedure very well.
Mm. What determines which of these types of screenings is most appropriate for a given patient, or does it really not matter patient to patient what kind of screening they undergo?
It depends. It's a conversation with the individual and their physician. We know that people who are at high risk really should have colonoscopy, and high risk meaning patients who've had a family history of colon cancer, particularly colon cancer that's developed in a family member who's a first-degree relative, meaning a parent, a sibling, or a child, before the age of 60, or they have multiple relatives with colon cancer, or what we call advanced polyps, large polyps. Those patients do better with colonoscopy because the risk of finding something like a polyp is higher, and at colonoscopy, the polyp could be removed at the time of the exam. For people we call of average risk who don't have that history, those folks do better with different ones based on the conversation between them and their physician. Some people will opt for stool-based testing, other with CT colonography, other with colonoscopy, and each of these has its drawbacks. I think the main message, though, is to have that conversation with your provider, healthcare provider, and get screened.
How frequent should screenings be, and does that the answer to that question change with a person's age?
The frequency depends upon the type of test that's used. If you do what's called the FIT test, which is a fecal immunochemical testing, which tests for part of blood called hemoglobin, that's a stool-based test that's done yearly. Now, if you use what's called the fecal FIT test, fecal immunochemical test, with the DNA testing, which is known as Cologuard, that's one that's done every 3 years. If you opt for the test that uses CT scanning or CT colonography, that's every 5 years. And if you opt for colonoscopy, that's every 10 years. Now, these intervals presume that you're not having any symptoms and that the initial test that was done was negative, meaning you're still being screened. If you're developing symptoms and have active symptoms that could suggest colon cancer, that needs to be addressed accordingly and would not be considered screening.
Right. And I want to ask you about symptoms in a moment. Can you tell us more about this Cologuard test? I understand that the Mayo Clinic had a hand in its development. In what way is this different from other kinds of colon cancer screenings that existed before?
Well, the first is it's based on two components. The first is the fecal immunochemical testing, which checks for the hemoglobin or the blood component. But also it looks at a particular characteristic of polyps and colon cancers, which is abnormal DNA or genetic material. These cancers shed this material into the stool, and the test actually can pick this up. And by picking it up, it increases the sensitivity, meaning the ability to find colon cancers and polyps much higher compared to a standard FIT or standard hemoglobin-based test to check the stool.
You yourself mentioned that the interval between screenings is with the assumption that somebody is not demonstrating the kind of symptoms that are often associated with the onset of colorectal cancer. What are the symptoms that people should be paying the most attention to?
Well, the symptoms mainly really consist of common ones would be rectal bleeding, any type of rectal bleeding. Often patients will attribute that to, for example, hemorrhoids or other findings that they consider that may be benign, but any rectal bleeding is significant and that needs to be discussed with a physician. Other issues have to do with change in bowel habits, any type of change in bowel habits, particularly constipation, abdominal pain, weight loss, these sorts of symptoms. Mm.
When somebody is experiencing blood, what is exactly happening in the colon or the rectum that is causing that excessive amount of blood to be present in the first place? What's going on there?
Well, it really depends on the reason, like you said. I mean, the blood can be as simple as just bleeding hemorrhoids that patients will have to polyps, to colon cancer, to other conditions as well, such as inflammatory conditions of the colon that develop that lead to bleeding as well. Bleeding can be painless or with pain, so depending on that, what we call the differential or the list of potential possibilities grows. But in my area, we have to think is what's the most dangerous consequence to the patient related to rectal bleeding? And, of course, the most dangerous consequence typically is colon cancer. So we have to be looking to exclude that.
So is it that there is the presence of polyps or tumors or whatever in the colon, and that somehow the colon itself is becoming inflamed, and that's what causes this excessive amount of blood that then appears in one's stool or urine?
No, actually, it has to do with the polyps themselves. It's not so much the inflammation, but the polyps, as they grow, have a tendency to bleed.
Ah.
And the larger they get, the more tendency they bleed, and certainly colon cancers are the most likely to bleed. So the idea is that you want to catch it. We know in colon cancer, we believe it starts with development of polyps, and that polyp then grows into cancer over time. We think that the average time it takes for a polyp then from its start to develop cancer is about 10 years. And the larger the polyp gets, the more likely it is to bleed. So the idea behind screening is you want to catch this early before it starts to bleed, because when it starts to bleed, you're more likely dealing with what we would call an advanced lesion or even a colon cancer. And the goal, of course, is to stop that or find those polyps early to remove them.
Hmm. Assuming that someone has not been screened as they should be, or for whatever reason, colon cancer is missed and is then found to be present, how treatable, generally speaking, is colorectal cancer?
It depends upon the stage, and the stage has to do with the tumor itself, where it is in the colon in terms of they start typically on the wall of the colon, and then with time the tumor can penetrate through the wall of the colon, and then eventually can actually go through the wall to the surrounding tissues and the lymph nodes, and then even move on to the liver and other organs. And the ability to treat is related to the stage. Superficial colon cancers that are just localized to the lining are very treatable. But, of course, those who had more we call metastases and such are much less treatable.
Right.
So that's really, again, the idea behind screening.
I appreciate the information that you have shared here. Is there a means by which people can get more information through the Mayo Clinic about what we've talked about?
Yes. You can go to the Mayo Clinic sites, mayo.edu or mayo.com are great sites. All those sites are excellent. And, of course, there's lots of good information out there through Centers for Disease Control and the NIH and so forth as well.
Very good. Dr. Mike Pico, a gastroenterologist with the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Pico, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
8:52 the time. This is the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about the escalating challenges faced by the U.S. military when it comes to recruitment. Of course, it was back in 1973 that the draft was abolished and replaced by an all-volunteer military. And in recent years, it has become more difficult for all branches of the military to attract qualified candidates. There are a number of reasons for that. Recently, the U.S. Department of Defense commissioned a study by CNA, a nonprofit research and analysis organization in Washington, D.C. I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Elizabeth Cleland, who is senior research scientist and economist at CNA, who was one of the leaders in the study that was recently completed on this important topic. So explain what the most significant factors are right now in terms of limiting the size of the potential recruitment pool for our military. Is it that there are a fewer number of people in that age group, or are there other factors that are also shrinking that pool of eligible candidates?
So the 17 to 24 population has remained relatively stable over the past 10 years in terms of the size of the population. But it's the whether or not they're qualified for military service that's been shrinking the pool. So recruiters are limited by whom they can bring into the service by various physical, moral, and mental aptitude requirements. So things like medical issues, obesity is increasing in the youth population, which is increasing the number of applicants disqualified for service.
And we see those numbers just going up in ways that apparently should cause us some alarm, I mean, for a number of reasons, but today what we're talking about is how it is, in a sense, ruling out many young people who might otherwise be qualified for and might otherwise be interested in a career in the military.
Correct. Only about 29% of youth in the 17 to 24-year-old population meet the requirements on the surface without a waiver. And if you consider those then who are going straight to college after high school, that number dwindles down to about 17% of the youth population. And then if you take into account the awareness of the military or the likelihood and interest someone's going to join, that pool shrinks even further to about 2 to 3% of the youth population. So recruiters are working in a very tight market when they're trying to convince youth to join the service.
Right. And of course, it's also an environment in which unemployment rates, at least in many places, are relatively low. I should think that is also a discouraging factor as well.
Right. It's the research has shown over the years that when unemployment rates fall, it's going to be harder and harder to recruit people to the military because they're going to have more civilian job opportunities out there. And so, and then you also have youth, like I said, going to college at greater rates than they have in the past.
Right. And of course, amongst the entire population, we all seem to have less awareness in general of the military and the nature of what it means to be a part of the military. I mean, fewer and fewer of us have people in our own lives and our own inner circles who are part of the military. So it just goes without saying that more and more young people do not have the kind of awareness that they might otherwise have of what it means to be part of the military. What is your advice for America's military in terms of trying to go after this shrinking pool? Are they making mistakes that they need to fix, and are there other ways in which they need to alter their tactics?
I wouldn't say that any mistakes are being made. I would just say it's becoming more and more difficult, like you say, to communicate the benefits of service when there's fewer role models in the community that have served in the military. Only about 15% of youth today have a parent who has served, compared to 40% in 1995. So the recruiter's job is really to communicate those intangible benefits of service, like service to country, honor, courage, commitment, and the tangible benefits like compensation, benefits of health care, money for college, and things like skills training. So that's really the job of the recruiter, is to make sure the youth are aware of those benefits.
Is there a place where people can get more information on some of the findings of CNA and their study of this important issue?
Yes, so we will be releasing this report that has been commissioned by the Office of the Secretary of Defense this week, and you will be able to find that report at cna.org, posted on the homepage.
Very good. Dr. Elizabeth Cleland is a senior researcher and scientist and economist at CNA. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Show. We'll be welcoming back to our studios Nan Calvert, and with her will be Adrian Sizek, who is with Stormwater Solutions Engineering. We'll be talking about the significance of stormwater runoff and why it is important for us to combat it. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and The Morning Show is available to you 7 days a week as a podcast through Spotify, Apple Podcast, or Google Podcast. Be sure to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show.